Hello, it's Wednesday, September the 15th. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Did you know dog owners are collecting pet hairs which they knit into jumpers? Who's going to wear them? The British Medical Association has dropped its opposition to assisted dyeing. Does it make it more likely it's going to happen? The winter plan for COVID. The Prime Minister has not ruled out another lockdown, but he's desperate to avoid it happening. But first, finally, it's long awaited, it's overdue in my opinion, Boris Johnson is reshuffling his cabinet. Finally, the long-awaited cabinet reshuffle has happened and probably more brutal than most people thought. The Prime Minister is notoriously thin-skinned, likes to be liked, likes to be popular, and was thought to be resisting a reshuffle, but it's been a bit of a night of the long knives. The Foreign Secretary has been demoted. We have a new woman Foreign Secretary. The Tory chairman has been sacked. Most people never heard of her, including me. And John Stevens, who, of course, is the Daily Mail's deputy political editor, is here to explain. John, probably the biggest change, but no surprise, Dominic Raab demoted as Foreign Secretary. He's now Justice Secretary, but has had a bit of a hissy fit and managed to get the title of Deputy Prime Minister thrown in to soften the blow.
Yeah, so we were expecting him to go, and he has been axed. But he had lengthy talks with the Prime Minister in his Commons office this lunchtime and has come out with this consolation prize, but he's very much still a demotion. He's no longer got one of the great offices of state, even if he does have this fancy new title.
Liz Truss is the new Foreign Secretary. She'd been the International Business Secretary. She'd won quite a lot of praise for doing about 60, 63 trade deals, not all of them particularly big deals, but she did better in that job, John, than some people might have expected.
Yeah, she's had a remarkable turnaround, really. You think a couple of years ago, she had a really miserable time as Justice Secretary. She was demoted, she became Chief Secretary of the Treasury, and she's been slowly building up since then, has now got one of those great offices of state. And, you know, she's very popular in the party, and I think that's partly why Boris Johnson put her into this position. And obviously, she seems to have done quite well on the international stage, signing all these trade deals.
And Robert Jenrick sacked as Housing Secretary. Many people thought he should have been fired over the fact he overturned a decision of a local council and a planning inspector to fast-track a planning permission for the Tory donor Richard Desmond. He's now been fired. He also blotted his copybook, John, hadn't he, with most Tory MPs, because he'd come up with these plans to build, massively expand house building on Greenbelt land.
Yeah, I mean, he had looked quite vulnerable quite a while ago, but because he's managed to cling on for so long, I think people were starting to think maybe he was going to stay on forever, that he wasn't actually ever going to get rid of him. But they've got rid of him, he's got rid of Robert Buckland, who was the Justice Secretary, and he's got rid of Gavin Williamson as well, the Education Secretary, as well as
the worst Education Secretary ever.
Exactly. I think that's the one person that everyone was pretty certain was going to get out of the cabinet. I mean, it was possible he might be able to get a new job in there, but I think Boris Johnson just thinks he's best to get rid of him, put him back on the back benches.
And Amanda Milling has gone as Tory chairman. Do we know who she's being replaced by?
Not yet. There's obviously just a couple of weeks to go until Tory party conference. So it's obviously going to be a lot of work for whoever gets that job to get that conference ready to go.
Yeah, and I see it's just been announced that Michael Gove is moving from the Cabinet Office. He's the new Housing Secretary. He'll be pleased with that, I think, because he's now got his own department to run.
Exactly. He's got something that he can get his teeth into. People were saying that he was quite bored in his role as Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. He didn't have any kind of main responsibilities. He was doing bits and pieces around the place. Obviously, now he's got his own department. He's also been in charge of looking at the union as well as levelling up an election.
And Oliver Dowden, he's the new Education Secretary. He's another old Etonian. Will there be criticism of that, John?
Well, maybe, possibly. But you look at the top jobs, you know, obviously you've got two of those held by women now, which is more than before. Before it was just Priti Patel. And I'd be interested to see how much he balances things up in the bottom half of the cabinet and his junior ministerial ranks, because obviously up until now it's been very white and male.
And he proved to be tougher in this reshuffle than perhaps, John, just finally most people thought. People thought he was putting this off and putting it off because he doesn't like upsetting people. This is going to have rattled quite a few cages.
Yeah, I think people were thinking that even though there was a lot of talk about a reshuffle, that the PM might bottle it, that he might get too worried about upsetting people. But you look at the names that have gone out today and you see that it's a proper full-on reshuffle going on as it happens.
Very interesting. That's John Stevens, Deputy Political Editor of the Daily Mail. We'll keep you up to date on the reshuffle on Mail Plus. And of course, the paper tomorrow will have comprehensive coverage of the reshuffle. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at Mail Plus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So the Prime Minister's paved the way for fresh COVID curbs this winter after scientists warned the virus could yet again potentially cripple the NHS. He's also refused to rule out a full lockdown. Boris Johnson says compulsory mask wearing, vaccine passports could be revived, and working from home could all be imposed if the vaccine programme fails to control the virus. I'm joined now by Dr. Lawrence Buckman, who's an NHS GP, and he's the former chairman of the British Medical Association General Practitioners Committee. Dr. Buckman, we know in the winter, COVID multiplies quicker and is potentially more lethal. How bleak do you think it could be?
Well, predictions range from not much different to a normal winter to an absolute nightmare where the NHS is overwhelmed. And quite honestly, we don't know. It rather depends on a whole variety of factors, many of which are not in our control, and we'll have to wait and see. What we have to do is make sure the NHS doesn't fall over during this time.
It's clear from the Prime Minister's language he wants to avoid a complete lockdown again. I think politically he'd find it very difficult to sell that to his MPs in Parliament. Do you think there'd be some sense in saying now, why not bring back compulsory mask wearing, for instance, on public transport and in shops to mitigate the potential impact of COVID ripping loose all over again?
I think we'd all be very keen to avoid a lockdown. I think a full lockdown, I think, would be something we'd go out of our way to avoid. And I would be perfectly happy to see mask wearing return, certainly in enclosed spaces. I think in public areas, I think it's something we should be approaching now rather than waiting, as it's highly likely that we're going to need that. And if that alone will contain everything, then I think that's a good idea. It also stops us getting flu and all the other viruses that are floating around in the winter. I'm in favour of mask wearing sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and also they're talking about encouraging people to work from home all over again. Now, we've just started, a lot of people have just started back in the office or the factory or wherever their workplace is. What's your view about that? I mean, how big a spreader is it, people returning to work? They're often using public transport, of course.
Public transport has never been shown to be a significant spreader of illness. But the workplace and indoor spaces that are not well ventilated are known to be viral spreading environments. And if we are not going to be able to ventilate properly and work in safe distancing properly, then we shouldn't be doing it. And we should be working, if we can, from home or from open air environments. That's difficult in the winter for many people, but it's safer than being together. And it's the reason why we didn't have a flu epidemic last year, because no one was meeting anyone else.
How interesting. And of course, there was a lot of talk about ventilation being improved in schools to try to ensure that we don't have education as so badly disrupted as it has been for the last 18 months. But very little was actually done about that. Do you think we need, Doctor, a whole new approach to working in offices and factories and public places about ventilation? Because this pandemic, this virus could be with us for years on end.
We're with the virus forever. And I think we need to think how we're going to deal with it. A large amount of work has been done, particularly in Japan and Israel, but also in America and here, on ventilation and how quite minor changes to ventilation make an enormous difference. If you think of all the people who work in what are effectively unventilated environments, all those lovely shiny glass office blocks that don't have any windows and it's all air conditioning and the airflow doesn't circulate properly, all of those environments, which were great until COVID, now are seen to be risky places to be. Opening one window alone makes a big difference. And the more you open the air, the more you are less likely to circulate droplets.
Why aren't we doing it then?
I think many buildings are remarkably difficult to adjust to the new world. And I think also people don't like being cold, and they're not very keen on being wet either. So there's a limit to how much ventilation you can tolerate. But yeah. I have no doubt that changing the ventilatory environment would make a big difference to droplet spread. And it is some places it's very easy, but other places it's very difficult, particularly if your building is sealed intentionally to make air conditioning work well and efficiently. And we may have to accept a lesser degree of air conditioning, of course.
Yeah, I think I'd rather be a bit chilly in the office than catch COVID.
Yes, well, so would I. Wear a jumper, wear a coat, wear something warmer. Try and get airflow. And there are airflow experts who can tell you exactly how to do it as well. Exactly where you sit relative to air inlets and air outlets makes a difference too. So just moving your chair a meter away from where it is now in the best direction, if we know what that is, will make you much safer than if you are right under an air vent.
Fascinating. I think we need to co-opt you, Dr. Buckman, onto some of the public health committees the government have got in Downing Street, because you've got some good ideas there. That's Dr. Lawrence Buckman, who's an NHS GP and former chairman of the BMA's General Practitioners Committee. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The British Medical Association, which represents around 150,000 members, has dropped its 15-year opposition to assisted dying. However, if assisted dying were to become legal, the BMA say they would support medics' right to refuse prescribing lethal doses of medication to patients if they object. I'm joined now by Trevor Moore, who's chairman of My Death, My Decision. Mr. Moore, is this a key moment, you think, in the long road, I imagine, that you're pursuing to try to get the law changed?
Yes, it is actually quite a watershed, in that when a bill last came before our parliament back in 2015, one of the main reasons that politicians gave for opposing the law was because the medical profession was opposed. And since then, there have been really quite seismic shifts. So the Royal College of Physicians have now gone neutral. Now we hear the British Medical Association. And that's really important, because that means they can take part in the debate, and so can their members. And we think it's really important that now politicians should have a public inquiry so that they can hear the evidence from experts around the world in other jurisdictions that have assisted dying laws, rather than opinion. I would say I'm very confident of our ground in our campaign, but opponents often come up with what I would say are alarmist reasons why we shouldn't have an assisted dying law, and an inquiry would be an opportunity for that to be scrutinised, so that politicians are making a decision on an informed basis rather than just sort of opinion, really.
I hear what you say about opinion, but I think one opinion that I thought was quite significant in this debate this week was George Carey, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, who
yes.
spoke out in favour of a proper debate about assisted dying. That, I imagine, would be an opinion you would welcome.
Absolutely, yes. One of the misconceptions people have is that people of faith must almost by definition be opposed to assisted dying, but as George Carey shows, and we have a board member who's senior in the Unitarian Church, you know, it's not a patron, Rosie Harper, who's a member of the General Synod. So I think it would be excellent to hear all the voices rather than people purporting to speak for complete groups, when, as we all know, in all campaigns, it's never quite as simple as that.
The of course, assisted suicide is currently illegal. Euthanasia, the act of a doctor deliberately giving a terminal or patient a drug they don't need with the aim of ending their life, that is regarded as manslaughter or murder. In reality, very few people, Mr. Moore, are ever charged with helping with assisted dying or euthanasia. So why do you think the law needs changing? Because it's happening already, isn't it?
Well, it shouldn't be happening within these borders, because assisting suicide is a criminal offence with a penalty of up to 14 years. Your listeners will probably be familiar with the so-called going to Switzerland, where several Dignitas. Organizations will, Dignitas, Life Circle and so on. You can be, in theory, prosecuted for accompanying someone to Switzerland who's chosen an assisted death. There haven't actually been prosecutions, because the Director of Public Prosecutions, one Keir Starmer at the time, issued some guidelines about the circumstances in which it would be in the public interest to bring a prosecution. And in most cases, you're going to fall within the ambit of that, and they will decide not to charge. But if you think that you've accompanied someone to their death, and you are grieving, and then you come home and you've got the threat of being charged, and you, people may say, well, you never will be, but actually, you know, psychologically, it's not a very nice thing to be hanging over you. And as we've understood it, it can sometimes be for many months before the police say, we're not going to proceed. But the other thing about in this jurisdiction, assisting someone to die, what our current law does is force people to either awful self-help methods or things like voluntary stopping eating and drinking, which leads to a very unpleasant death. And something like, when we last did the maths, 350 million people around the world now live in countries that allow assisted dying. There are decades of experience that show, with robust safeguards, it's something that society really takes on board. It's an option. In Canada, they call it End of Life Option Act. And so why shouldn't people have that choice if they're the ones who are suffering, and not to be told by clinicians or whatever that, you know, well, sorry, but we're going to give you palliative care medicine?
Just finally, you know, one of the arguments against assisted dying, Mr. Moore, is that unscrupulous children or people might encourage or bully or cajole elderly relatives who aren't well into assisted dying, because perhaps they want to get their hands on their money, or perhaps they're just fed up with looking after them, and that people will feel pressurized into going down that route. How do you counter that argument?
Well, first of all, in those countries that have these laws, there's absolutely no evidence of that happening. But also, the processes are so thorough and require time intervals and two independent experts. The idea that someone can force Auntie Flo to go and have an assisted death when it's not her true motive, it's just that her children want to get her the inheritance. They can use things like lasting powers of attorney or other means if they want to get at her assets. They don't, you know, the idea that you would force someone through an assisted death just seems to me an alarmist argument that's raised by opponents. But when you actually investigate it, it's not borne out, which is why I think there should be a public inquiry.
All right. That's Trevor Moore, who's chairman of My Death, My Decision. Thanks for joining us. Sports time now with Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood. So Manchester United, even with the aristocratic Cristiano Ronaldo, they lose in Europe in their first game.
I know. So the Champions League is back. We had the first two games for English clubs last night, and a shock result already for Man United, who lost to Young Boys, the bizarrely named Swiss side, 2-1.
Why are they called that?
It's a very good question. I have no idea.
Are they young?
Well,
are
I don't think it's. I don't think it's a prerequisite that you have to be under 22 to play for them.
Right.
So, Ronaldo was obviously not a young boy, 36, as you say. He scored again, so he continued his great start. But the team a very poor start, because they would have, you know, fully expected to go and win there. When you look at the talent they had on the pitch, including Ronaldo and Fernandes, etc. But they had a man sent off. They played for 60 minutes with 10 men, and they couldn't hang on to the lead that Ronaldo had given them. So poor start for them. And actually, continues a trend of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as the manager underperforming in Europe. He's lost something like 7 out of his 11 European ties now. So they've got a lot of work to do now to get out of the group, which, you know, you'd still back them to do, but not a dream start for them.
And Chelsea, however...
Chelsea. just continue on. Lukaku, who they've signed, much like Man United, an old player returning to them.
Right.
Lukaku back for his second spell with Chelsea and cannot stop scoring, much like Ronaldo, but his team won. So they got off to a good start, beating Zenit St. Petersburg 1-0. Lukaku scored again. So they're sitting pretty. They've got Juventus in their group, and you'd think that the two of them, Chelsea and Juventus, will be the top two, and they'll go through. So good start for them, and a poor start for Man United. And then we've got the other two teams tonight. So Liverpool are playing AC Milan. So that's I know you'll be watching that one, because that's an absolute classic of two teams who've won the competition 13 times between them. So that's a real big Milan back to trying to rediscover past glory. So that'll be a good game. And Man City are playing Leipzig as well. So the other two in action tonight.
And just finally, Matt, a GB sprinter is lost a Tokyo medal. What's that about?
Yes, yeah, so I know you were obviously glued to the Olympics,
yeah.
And we were all cheering on the Brits, and we were so delighted for them. Well, we won a silver medal in the 4x100 relay in the men's. But it looks like we'll lose that medal now. That's going to be stripped from the team, because one of the sprinters, CJ Uja, has failed a drugs test, basically. So he failed
that
it.
That means the whole team loses.
Well, the whole team, yeah. You can't have one man who fails a drugs test and the rest, you know, no matter what. So his sample tested positive a little while ago. He got his B sample back yesterday, because he's not obviously, but he is insisting he's innocent. So they sent his B sample away to be retested. And that has failed the drugs test as well. So the only chance now he's got is to take it to the Court of Arbitration for Sport to see if he can find some way to wriggle off the hook. But it looks very much like the medal count will drop by one for Tokyo. So a bit of a blow for the Brits and for the others.
That's horrible. And I hope, if it's confirmed that he's a drugs cheat, they don't let him ever put on a Team GB shirt again.
Well, he'll face a 4-year ban if he's found guilty. That's what he'll be given. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
4-year bans are not enough. It should be a lifetime ban.
It should. You're right. Absolutely. I mean, he is 27, so, you know, he may be... he'd potentially got a chance to come back. He is claiming that it's a substance he took that wasn't labelled correctly. Same old. We've heard all that before. Real shame.
All right, that's Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood, and we'll, of course, get the latest on the European football for you tomorrow. So would you wear a scarf or even a jumper made from your dog's hair or somebody else's dog's hair? Andrew Devine specialises in spinning dog hair at her cottage in an Essex village. Now, the craft of spinning wool from dogs apparently is called Chiengora and dates back as far as prehistoric Scandinavia. Northern breeds of dogs apparently have downy undercoats, which they shed every year, and they're not coated in weatherproof wax. They therefore don't smell and are perfect for spinning. Andrew joins me now. So, Andrew, tell me more. What do you spin the wool on?
Spinning wheel.
You do?
Yeah. It takes a while to... perfect it, but it's fine once you can do it. It takes a while. Any breed of dog can be spun, by the way.
Right.
Everything is washed, and there's not a heart in there. There's nothing living once you've got the fur, so it doesn't matter. You know, it's fine. It will never smell again anyway. And most of the fur I get anyway is quite clean when it comes.
Right. Well, now, where do you get it from?
From customers who want something made from their own dogs. So they save the fur by brushing. You get the undercoat out. The dog has the undercoat, but it also has the guard hairs, which give the lovely colours to the dog's fur. But they are prickly, so that's why we like it brushed out, and you get the fine undercoat that spins lovely.
Right. So to make, for instance, I don't have a dog, but if I've got a dog I'm very fond of, if I wanted you to make a scarf from her fur, how long would it take you to make it, and how much fur do you need?
Well, I've only made one because I think it's too hot to wear.
Oh,
but
do you? That's
scarf
interesting.
Scarf is fine. Yeah, it is. Yeah. They're about 5, 6, even 10 times warmer than wool. It's far too hot. You couldn't keep them on for very long at all. But scarves you can line, and scarves can be worn over something, whereas garments to your skin, even if it's a fine undercoat, in my opinion, is too prickly.
That's interesting. So what do you tend to make, and what do your customers ask you to make?
I make dogs out of their dogs, so I try to make the dogs look like their dogs. They're about 12, 14 inches long. They're not small. They're a nice size. So if it's a retriever, it'll have floppy ears, look like a retriever, try to make the face look like the dog. And a shepherd will have pointed ears. So I make dogs. I also make cushions and hearts.
Right.
Which is lovely to keep. And it's not itchy at all. It's lovely to touch. Yeah.
And how did you learn how to spin dog fur on a spinning wheel?
Ah, I was taught years ago by a friend just to spin wool. And then I had two Cocker Spaniels, saved their fur for some reason, didn't want to, you know, throw it away. And I thought, I'll try that out. And it was lovely, even though it looked like rope, because it was my dog's fur, I was really pleased with it. And I thought, I love that. So now I've perfected it so I can spin really fine, do you see, which is much nicer.
Yes.
And I thought other people probably like that. So that's why I asked a friend if she would like something made. She loved it. I made a cushion for her. And that's how it's gone on. And I have customers all over the world. I simply love what I do. You have to have a passion.
How nice.
Because it does take a lot of your time up. Now, for a scarf, I actually use, for Michelle, I use 10. I asked for 10. Well, I got 10 ounces. And I suppose it took... See, there's different processes. You don't just spin it and knit it. You card it first so all the hairs go the same way, a line, so that it's able to spin on a spinning wheel. Then you let it rest once you've spun it. You let it rest on a container. And then you two-ply it. You have to two-ply it because you need the shaft to be straight for knitting. Otherwise, it'll go all one way. If it's just one ply, it won't look right. So you have to two-ply it. Then you wash it. And then I put weights on it so it sets it and let it dry. So that's the process of... and then I knit it and then I design a pattern for whatever breed of dog I'm doing. So I suppose a dog would take 24 hours, but that would be over a couple of days, do you see, or 2 days, because you've got to wait for the process to work.
I get you. And can you do anything with cat hair?
Yes. Now, cat hair is completely different to dog. It's not cat hair, it's cat fur, whereas dog's is hair. So even rabbit, I do rabbit as well. It's different, it's fur, it clings. When you spin it, it clings, whereas the hair is more difficult. The undercoat is not too bad with the dog hair. But with rabbit, because people will think, it's not very long, because it's not Angora rabbits, I do any rabbit. And cats, it's not always the Persian. It can be just an ordinary moggy, So it's the type, because it's fur, it clings when you spin it. When you spin it round, it clings, it knits together. It's lovely. It's beautiful.
It sounds fascinating, Andrew. Well, it's a whole new world you've opened up here.
I love it.
Well, you speak with passion about it and with great enthusiasm, and I'm sure people will find you. That's Andrew Devine, who specialises in spinning dog hair, and now we discover cat fur and rabbits too. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.